Nothing is more enjoyable in this super fun job than sitting down with Dr. Peter Ravden, creator of Adjuvant Online. In our most recent conversation, I've picked Peter's brain about how data from genomic predictive assays like Oncotype and MammaPrint integrate into more traditional clinical factors as utilized in Adjuvant Online, but we began our conversation by commenting on the evolving presenting face of the disease.
One of the things that's been interesting over the last decade are changes in mortality of breast cancer and also changes in incidence. And a lot of emphasis has been given to the changes in mortality. And there has been some improvement in mortality, largely attributable, I think, to adjuvant therapy. But one of the things that isn't as widely discussed is that there's been a major change in breast cancer incidence, about a 50% increase since 1990. And actually, if you take a look at detail at that increase, what you find is that it's almost totally due to an increase in stage 1 estrogen receptor positive disease. Incidentally, there has been a 2- to 3-fold increase in the amount of that disease in terms of absolute numbers. And that corresponds over that same interval with basically a 5-fold increase in DCIS. I think the two are linked in that I think detection technologies are getting more widely used. The reading is better. And as a result, we're detecting a lot more disease. And I think that some of the disease, as DCIS illustrates, some of the disease is actually not lethal disease. And that the general prognosis of breast cancer patients is improving in part because of the detection of this early low-aggressiveness form of disease.
So a la prostate cancer PSA.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. You increase your detection kind of technologies, and this is really going to doom the idea of detection technologies unless we get much better ways of discriminating between what disease that stage 1 disease or, say, node-negative disease is truly aggressive biologically and what of that disease is basically benign, DCIS-like. And this is actually, prostate cancer is, the analogy here is very strong. So it is an opportune time to have some of the stronger molecular profiling tests come along because they're really badly needed.
And I guess that's a natural lead into what those tests are, and particularly the issue of the Oncotype and MammaPrint, the two available assays. Can you talk a little bit about how you see those two in terms of the data behind them, the techniques, et cetera?
Okay. These two tests basically take a look into a molecular profile based on RNA. So in theory, they're both very similar. In practice, however, they are quite different. The Oncotype test, also called the 21-gene assay, is a test that actually works on fragments of mRNA. And so the mRNA can be degraded. There are ways of standardizing the test against kind of other genes that are not really affected by malignancy. And the bottom line is that that test, therefore, can be done on archive material because it can be done on paraffin-embedded fixed material. And that opens up rapid development of the test because most of the big cooperative groups have been collecting their block materials now for over a decade and actually back into the 1980s, retrospectively gone back and collected material. And so that test has an enormous advantage in terms of development. Then there's the MammaPrint test, which is a test that's dependent on 70 genes. It's dependent on intact mRNA. And therefore, because we really haven't been banking intact, say it has to be basically frozen or specially preserved in alcohol tissue, that we haven't been banking that material from the big clinical trials. And so they've been actually basically dependent on institutional series in which the therapy has not been absolutely standardized as it has been in the cooperative group trials.
I mean, do they have data in terms of MammaPrint the way you have with Oncotype, which sort of predicts benefit from chemotherapy?
They don't. The problem is that they don't have a good comparison group. So all of the MammaPrint data is really focused on prognosis.
And it needs fresh tissue.
Right. So one of the things that they're doing is they're actually, that's the genesis of the MINDAC trial,
right,
which is a prospective trial in which some of the patients are being randomized to get chemotherapy or not. And those patients are having mammoprint profiles done. That ultimately will tell us a number of years from now what we already know for the Oncotype test. And they already, for Oncotype, essentially were able to retrospectively go back. And it's been done in two studies. Now, about 3 years ago, the results were reported from NSABP-B20, which is a trial that randomized patients between simple observation, or in this case, it was really tamoxifen, or tamoxifen plus CMF. Actually, there were some of the patients that got MF in that trial. And more recently, this year, actually, late last year, was reported the results of the Southwest Oncology Group 8814. And in that trial, patients who were postmenopausal and ER positive were randomized between tamoxifen alone or tamoxifen plus CAF.
That was node positive, though.
Those were node positive patients. And the original development was done in NSABP in node negative patients.
I want to ask you about that recent node positive data. There are a lot of questions about that, but just about the MINDEC trial. I thought it's interesting that basically what they do is they look at the mammoprint score and then they look at the risk of recurrence based on adjuvant, your mm-hmm. model. And I guess the ones that randomize are where there's sort of a discrepancy, where right. one of them is saying it's higher risk and the other is not. I thought it was really kind of a cool design. And it really gets into the whole issue of the kinds of variables that go into adjuvant as opposed to these genetic tests. And we've been asking people patterns of care. Again, what do you do if your Oncotype says one thing, yet the mm-hmm. basic factors in adjuvant tell you something else? What's your take on that?
I actually think that the Oncotype test, its individual factors in a number of ways are more powerful than classical pathology. And the reason for that is that grading is something that's really a qualitative estimate. And it's broken down into, you know, basically three levels. And the boundaries between the levels are not absolute. So patients could be called by one pathologist sometimes a grade two or a grade three. And there's no doubt that it's prognostic. But the bottom line is that there are a fair number of patients, and depending on what study you look at, it can be like 20 or 30% that are not called consistently by pathologists because they lie near boundaries. I think that the wave of the future really is taking a look at individual genes and then making a composite score on those, because that can be done quantitatively and is less observer dependent.
I guess the biggest thing that comes in with a classic so-called Oncotype situation where it's ER positive, HER2 negative, node negative is tumor size. Mm-hmm. For example, a tumor that's very small but yet has an intermediate high Oncotype score, a tumor that's large, you know, 2-3.5 centimeters, yet has a low Oncotype score. How do you kind of see that in terms of making clinical decisions?
Well, I think that ultimately, although it has not yet been done, it's being worked on, is the idea that prognostic factors are going to make a difference. Classic pathology is going to make a difference even when you have a gene profile. Because, you know, your gene profile is going to tell you something about the aggressiveness of the cancer. The size of the cancer could then tell you, all other things being equal, how long the cancer has been there. And I think you see signatures of that also in terms of nodal status. For instance, if you take a look at what would be a very favorable Oncotype score in a node-negative patient, that same Oncotype score in 8814 actually doesn't have such a favorable prognosis. And yet within 8814, and this might sound confusing, within 8814, the Oncotype score is prognostic. It's just the low risk isn't the very, very low risk seen in node-negative patients. It's actually a substantial risk.
Well, maybe you can go through that study. I mean, the takeaway I saw was that even though the baseline risk of recurrence in these node-positive patients, even in the low risk or low Oncotype score, was substantial, the thing that was striking to me was it looked like there wasn't any benefit of chemotherapy in those patients.
Right. I think that the really exciting thing that we have not been able to achieve with classical pathology is the idea of predicting benefit. And there have been some hints in classical pathology that, you know, the low-grade ER-positive cancers tend to get less benefit, but they haven't been pursued in quite the thoroughness that this has been pursued for the genetic profiles. And so the genetic profiles actually show that consistently across studies, the patients that have low-risk genetic profiles, and that's characterized within the Oncotype as having low proliferative rate and a combination of other genes, that actually those patients, essentially the ones at low risk, in no study have those patients been shown to get any benefit from chemotherapy. The chemotherapy benefit in studies where there's been an arm that's clearly benefited from chemotherapy over the other arm has been in the patients who have high oncotype scores. I think there's school is still out about the patients who have intermediate oncotype scores. And so where that boundary lies is a little bit ambiguous. But I think as a clinician, if you're looking at a patient and you're ambivalent about treating the patient on the basis of prognosis, and you see that they have a very low oncotype score, an additional piece of information that strongly sways you is that there is no clinical evidence, or let's say there's substantial clinical evidence that those patients don't benefit much from either CMF or CAF. That's, you know, two studies done in somewhat different populations with different chemotherapeutic regimens, and certainly doesn't cover the entire spectrum of possible questions that might be asked. But it's a consistent story that those patients don't benefit from therapy. On the other hand, the patients with high proliferative rates in both of those studies were the patients who obtained substantial benefit. So if you had a patient who you're ambivalent about treating on the basis of prognosis and you saw that they had a very high recurrence score, I think that would sway you in the direction of considering treatment, in that you'd know that that patient would experience at least the average benefit, probably more than had been seen in the trial.
Now, there are a bunch of caveats that Kathy Ebbing made when she presented these data at San Antonio in terms of how the study was done, how many patients were, you know, the whole A to Z. I mean, you can go through that. But bottom line is, do you feel that the data that was presented was enough for you to be fairly comfortable in saying to a patient, it looks like, for example, with node-positive tumor and a low recurrence score, you know, you probably won't get benefit from chemo? Or is this way too preliminary to be able to say that to a patient?
I think most people are still cautious about that in node-positive patients because it is one study. It's a relatively modest number of patients. The curves actually, you know, they show multivariate analysis, extrapolation curves, and they've actually begun to report those as well. But there are some weaknesses in those curves. One of them is that there's only 5 years of follow-up on those trials. Now, actually, there are 10 years of follow-up, actually 12 years of follow-up for the trial. And the reporting, the statistics was actually stronger at 5 years than 10 years. And I think there was some bias in the reporting of the trial to report, as we all do, try to report the most consistent and most convincing part of our story. But at 10 years, I don't think the story was quite as convincing. And I'm waiting to actually see the publication rather than just act on an abstract. Certainly, I think that there are some patients, however, that using that information would make sense.
Like what kind of patients?
I think that patients with, say, one node who otherwise actually have a fairly good prognosis even on using classical pathologic features, and then if they're ER positive and have a low oncotype score, those patients have a low risk to begin with, even if the chemotherapy had a modest activity but less than average, like a 10% activity, those patients would be getting 1% benefit and shouldn't be treated.
I wonder, too, also about patients. I mean, oncotype was always about the patients and docs on the fence, one way or the other. There was never any point to do it if you knew what you were going to do. We had a case recently we presented on our program. We presented to a couple of people of an 86-year-old woman with a triple-negative tumor and 7 positive nodes. And the woman was in perfect condition. Mm-hmm. They went on adjuvant together, mm-hmm. looked at the numbers, and she's like, you know, give me the chemo. She was a super 86-year-old. And I was thinking, I was wondering about a patient like that, or a same patient with 1 positive node, or a patient with a lot of comorbidities, or a healthier, younger patient who just had a lot of concerns about taking chemo. Do you think in that situation the oncotype could be another piece of information that would help?
Yes. I think that, you know, you always use all the information you have at hand. And consistently across trials, what you see is the fact that the oncotype assay, and this is in neoadjuvant study that was done in Italy and in the two American studies we've talked about, the patients with low recurrence scores seem to be getting little benefit from chemotherapy. Now, the reason for caution is, I think that, let's say a patient walks in with 6 positive nodes and she's ER positive, and, you know, I just still don't feel comfortable with the idea that a physician should feel that on the basis of very few patients, probably in the 8814 for patients with 4 or more nodes, the number of patients, I believe it was less than 100. And so should those patients on the basis of 100 patients from one trial establish a new national standard of care that the very modest number of them that had low recurrence score shouldn't get treated? I think that more information will be coming. I think that it hasn't actually mandated that we not treat those patients. However, I think it's like anything else in medicine. I think there are some people who will take the information that's available and will use it to shade, together with a lot of other information, the decision about whether or not such a patient should be treated.
What about genetic markers in patients with ER-negative tumors? I guess MammaPrint theoretically is doing that. What's the future of that?
Well, I think that that's certainly an area as well that can be explored and is possibly important. I'm not impressed by the MammaPrint assay right now in that domain. And what I'm not impressed about is in the ER-negative patients, they were mostly high recurrence score. And so you can almost use ER. Now, that may be unfair, but I haven't seen it, the analysis broken out by ER status as to how well the fits are, you know, what the actual prognosis is in the different groups. Whereas we don't have any data on ER-negative patients, I'd like to see the curve stratified by ER within the MammaPrint. And I think the reason why we haven't seen that is because they're working on series from hospitals and have relatively low numbers of patients.
I guess, too, I think I emailed you about this. There were kind of some interesting letters to the editor, the JCO, that went back and forth about this because I guess it was the ASCO Tumor Markers Committee and NCCN, which sort of supported Oncotype but didn't support MammaPrint. Some of the people who developed MammaPrint wrote into the JCO saying, well, MammaPrint's, quote, FDA approved or accepted, Oncotype isn't. It's used in ER negative, Oncotype isn't. What do you think about that sort of debate?
I think one of the things to realize is that the FDA's approval of tests are that they measure something, but not that they are clinically useful. I'm actually not an admirer of the MammaPrint assay. And their validation study, you know, their index study suggested a relative risk of 5 is conferred, which suggests that a MammaPrint assay is a very strong independent predictor. So that was their index study. Their validation study was a study in which the relative risk was 2. The confidence intervals did not overlap. And, you know, we have lots of things that confer a relative risk of 2. And when you remember that in their index study, they actually mixed in a few patients from their development study, there was a suggestion of overfitting. The other thing about the test, which may be right, but I'm a little bit cautious about, is the idea that it defines a high risk and a low risk population. So good and bad risk. They have a very strong dichotomy in terms of, you know, supposedly from the index study, although, as I said, the validation study is not that impressive. I was surprised that the FDA actually gave them approval, but in retrospect, I'm not that surprised. I think that because it was approved as a test that legitimately measures mRNA, but whether or not it's truly prognostic, and I think also because hopefully these tests will actually allow you to have some prediction of treatment effect. So the Oncotype test is a step in that direction, whereas the very way that the test is being developed for the MammaPrint, because they can't do it on clinical trial material, at least that's present at the moment, you know, it's going to be a slow process to be able to get that information.
I also just became aware of another group, I don't know, the university group. Matt Ellis was telling me about this. They had a bunch of presentations at ASCO. Charles Peru are working on, I think there's several universities working on this, developing a genomic predictor that's based on the breast cancer Peru subtypes. Do you know anything about that?
Yes. Actually, I can't quote the literature there with as much completeness as the other literature. But I think the concept is, and Peru has pursued this, that there are subtypes of breast cancer. For instance, 2 subtypes, luminal A and luminal B, which are ER-positive subtypes, and that, in fact, the Oncotype test is discriminating between those 2 groups. But there are also groups that are called the basal or triple negatives and the HER2 subtype and possibly another subtype of ER-negatives. I think it will turn out that there actually are fairly distinctive major patterns of breast cancer And I think that they're going to be definable in a number of ways. I think the idea that the Oncotype 21 gene assay is some magic and hit upon the 21 genes is certainly not true. But there'll be other subsets of genes that could be used and obtain basically or identifying a subset of disease that is low risk.
Another issue that's come up is this type of methodology to get a better take on ER and HER2. And now Oncotype, as of the last few months, is also reporting quantitative ER. Where do you think things are heading in terms of measurement of ER and HER2? Is RT-PCR sort of where we're going to be going in the future?
I think it will be. And I think it's a very useful thing that they're reporting ER because, first of all, there's been many indications that ER level actually does help predict response to tamoxifen and suggestions that it may refine responsiveness to chemotherapy eventually as well, perhaps in combination with other things. And so the idea of reporting these values, and already I'm aware of clinical situations where patients had an ambiguous borderline ER, and everybody would routinely treat those patients with hormonal therapy at the moment, but to have the information that the patient was truly negative, that there was no evidence of mRNA for ER, would, I think, help refine the decisions in those cases. On the other hand, patients who have clearly ER positivity by that assay, I think you'd have much more confidence that you might treat them with hormonal therapy.
Could you envision a situation where the quantitative ER might drive decisions, you know, in another way? I mean, for example, let's say metastatic disease. You're trying to decide, do I want to just use hormones? Do I have to start chemo? The patient's sick. Maybe adjuvant choice of hormones with the hormone level, the ER level, you know, if it's borderline positive versus super high positive, change what you would choose. Do you think we're moving in that direction?
Yes. I think that basically right now on metastatic disease, it would also be one of those situations that would be useful. And I'm aware of a case where a patient had initially a borderline ER and then had a biopsy that was borderline ER. And it really would have made a difference for this person to know whether or not there was mRNA, because so often you're in a clinical situation where you don't want to waste weeks of time waiting for hormone to work unless you have really pretty solid confidence that the patient's going to respond to hormonal therapy. So it's interesting. There's, as far as I know, no real studies in metastatic disease with these profiles, but there certainly is a place where they would potentially be of value.
What about HER2? Do you think we're moving in a direction where something like Oncotype is going to report quantitative HER2? I heard a case yesterday, one of our Meet the Professor cases that somebody wanted to present, where locally the tumor was read as IHC3+. For some reason, it was sent for Oncotype, which normally people don't do, and, quote, the Oncotype people or GH people called back and said, there's no HER2 in here. Does that make any sense?
That's one of those things that it makes some sense. I'm not sure I would use it for clinical decision-making at the moment.
Do you think we're moving in that direction?
I think we are. I think that, in a way, FISH is already a step in that direction. And one of the things that we haven't talked about but is a potential challenge to the profiling is the idea that single genes, if well measured, can provide much of the information that profiles can deliver. So, for instance, right now for HER2, there is a very solid body of evidence that patients who are HER2 positive get a particular amount of benefit from anthracycline-based chemotherapy.
Right.
And there's a developing information along the same road with topoisomerase. So that those are really important avenues, and it might be cheaper and easier to do single genes than to do elaborate profiles. I think that one of the little pieces of the presentation of 8814 that was presented but not really commented on very much is, in fact, HER2 was just as predictive of the effects of chemotherapy as was the Oncotype DX test in that.
They have HER2 on those patients?
They had HER2. They'd done it 2 years previously.
Huh.
And what happened was they were able to identify 40% of the patients who were strongly ER positive, who were HER2 negative, and who got no benefit from chemotherapy, which is...
And that was anthracycline chemo.
That was anthracycline. And it was just, it was nearly identical to the results reported for the Oncotype DX test. One thing that they did, which I think was not completely necessary nor fair to the HER2, is they said, well, we wanted to make it even better. So we added in grade. So we found that we could make it even stronger by adding in grade. So if you were HER2 negative grade 1 and strongly ER positive, you even more strongly predicted that you didn't benefit from chemotherapy. But we only identified 3% of the patients with that characteristic. Well, that wasn't necessary to add in the grade into that equation.
You mentioned before the Italian study that looked at Oncotype in the neoadjuvant situation. That really kind of makes a lot of sense. What do we know about these genomic factors in predicting response to chemo in the neoadjuvant setting? And for that matter, how does ER predict response to neoadjuvant chemo?
Well, that's a place where also I guess you could say that single genes may actually predict benefit, because across neoadjuvant studies, patients who are ER positive, their response rates to neoadjuvant therapy are really very low. They're 10%, whereas it's several times higher for patients who are ER negative. Now, a similar effect was seen, of course, using Oncotype in the Gianni trial, the Italian study, in which the patients who had very favorable Oncotype scores also didn't seem to benefit from the therapy.
I want to get your quick take on a couple of adjuvant papers that were just presented at ASCO that were pretty interesting. And of course, one was the lead meeting plenary presentation by Mike Nant from the Austrian group looking at premenopausal women, all of whom got LHRH agonist, none of whom got chemo. Node positive, some, node negative, a lot more. At this point, they didn't see any difference in those patients between anastrozole and tamoxifen, but it was pretty interesting, like 35% reduction in relapse rate in the women who got zoledronate. What was your take on those data?
I think it was a spectacular effect. And, you know, there have been hints from that in other trials. And in this case, they used a strong IV bisphosphonate, not clodronate.
Although it was every 6 months, which was interesting.
Yeah, they gave it every 6 months. And I think that, you know, it's another Herceptin. I mean, that's the kind of effects we saw for trastuzumab.
That's true.
And I think it's actually, the thing that's really wonderful about it is it's applicable to all the patients instead of a small subset of the patients.
Well, I guess at this point, the purists are saying, theoretically, just ER positive, premenopausal, not getting chemo, et cetera, et cetera. Mike Nant is like, well, maybe ER positive, postmenopausal, and pre. There's a lot of debate right now.
I think that it has an enormous import. And it was a mixture of patients in the study. You know, we're going to have more information about this soon. For instance, right. The NSABP study is about to, I believe it's closed and probably is going to report you know, reasonably soon.
Clodronate.
Yeah. And so I think that it's also consistent with some other things. I've looked at that data again. One of the questions that was interesting was that some of the other studies, at least one of the studies, had suggested that there might be an effect on visceral disease too, which was surprising.
And here they saw contralaterals less, they held distant mets, non-bone mets were less. Local recurrence was less?
Local recurrence was definitely
strange,
less.
Man.
And so, you know, it may be a broader effect than simply a local osseous effect.
So in terms of clinical decision makings today, assuming it can get paid for, do you think it's something that's reasonable to bring up to patients as an option, or should we wait?
I think that particularly if a patient is getting an aromatase inhibitor, where you're already shading whether or not you should treat, I think the story gets compelling that those patients should be treated with a bisphosphonate.
Now, are you saying in terms of also hitting the bone at the same time?
Right, that's right. So you're saying, okay, well, if a patient has some mild osteopenia, I could just observe it for a while, and when it gets worse, I could start treating. This argues that you should probably start treating those patients earlier. Now, the study was done in premenopausal patients, but I think the argument that they're basically acting like they're postmenopausal after the ovarian suppression, at least to me, is fairly convincing. I think, you know, the story is, it's a little bit different than the trastuzumab story in that there weren't three trials that were all reported at the same meeting. But I think that we're going to see the other shoes fall here over the next say, 2 to 3 years. And then I hope that they show what this study showed, because a 35% effect on a drug whose major side effect is that you don't get osteopenic would be wonderful.
The other paper I wanted to ask you about from ASCO that I was quite surprised about was Hai Musa's presentation of the CALGB study in women over age 65, comparing capecitabine in the adjuvant setting to either CMF or AC, and pretty significant benefit in favor of the AC and CMF. What did you think about that?
There are a couple of different ways of looking at that study. One of the ways is to say, the overview meta-analysis has been panning monotherapy for the last 20 years. And so perhaps this is just another thing that says that polychemotherapy works better. I was a little bit surprised. I think that most of us as clinicians have seen patients with metastatic disease get long-term benefit of the sort that you might get from CMF, and we kind of thought that that meant that Xeloda would be a good drug in a population of patients in the adjuvant.
And in the metastatic setting, of course, the basis of the trial was that Xeloda looked pretty good against, other kinds of chemo and meds.
Right. So I think that it was, in some ways, a surprise.
Kind of made me think a little bit about the presentation Joe Ragaz made at the San Antonio meeting this past December, questioning, when we see a lot of benefit in the metastatic setting from a therapy, used some examples, including trastuzumab. Yes, we need to do trials in the adjuvant setting, but maybe we shouldn't be so slow to kind of get started on it while the trials are going. What were your thoughts about that? Because I guess in this situation, the capecitabine, you didn't see it play out Mets to adjuvant maybe the way you expected.
Yeah, I think that that argument that what happens in metastatic disease plays out in terms of micrometastatic disease, or essentially the adjuvant treatment, is usually right, but it's not always right. And some of the exotic new agents we're going to use are going to be affecting microvasculature, which might be much more important in an established tumor than in micrometastatic disease.
Or less important.
Or less important. Yeah, I mean, we simply, we probably know less than 1% about what there is to know about the biology of human tissue. And so there are going to be a lot of surprises. And so I think the simple idea that observations in metastatic disease, there's certainly strong leads that should be followed up. There was another strong lead, actually, and that was another trial in there. It was the Tango trial from the UK, in which they had added gemcitabine to an anthracycline taxane regimen, which you'd predict for metastatic disease would be wonderful. And in fact, there was absolutely no additional benefit. So that's another case of where something which was observed in metastatic disease simply didn't translate into adjuvant therapy.
One of the things I've heard a lot of people ask me about is the issue of your adjuvant model and the HER2-positive patient. I think we've been thinking about that it might be coming up pretty soon now for a while, and you still don't have it posted. What's going on with that?
What's going on is that we simply don't have large population-based subsets of patients registry. SEER does not collect HER2 data. And so a lot of it has to be, based on clinical trial series. I think the numbers are that we've been about to release it now every 2 weeks for like the last year. And I think that some refinement, some additional data has become available to build our confidence that we have good numbers.
I mean, can you even right now put in there HER2 as a predictive factor, even moving away from trastuzumab? I know you had at one point.
Oh,
you,
yes.
You were telling me about 50% higher risk. I mean, is that in the model?
Or can it is. It's about a 1.5-fold higher risk.
So can you enter that right now, HER2 positive in
you
your model?
You cannot on the website.
Right.
But we actually have everything on the web, but we haven't activated it yet prior to, just some additional kind of checking of the program in general.
So basically, you told me in the past was you just take the risk of relapse that adjuvant generates right now and then multiply by 1.5. Is that the case?
Right. Well, basically what you do is the baseline risk is you multiply by 1.5.
Regardless whether it's low or high.
That's right.
Interesting.
There are arguments. One of the places, for example, is that there are a few people that insist that very small tumors with HER2 have a very bad prognosis. But I'm not quite so sure that that isn't a case of positive publication bias.
Yeah, I mean, there's very little data on it, I think, isn't it?
Most of the series are small. And
you can't get it out of SEER, as you're saying.
You can't get it out of SEER. I've seen subsequently at least one other big series that is going to be published in the near future, which doesn't show that effect. So
it doesn't show the increased risk of relapse?
It shows it, but as a modest independent factor. If you've taken grade into account and ER into account, it is not that powerful an independent predictor.
And this specifically in the low, small, no negative?
Specifically in the cases that were, say, one centimeter or less. Now, there are other people that espouse the idea that it's a higher risk. But to me, looking at it, and it discusses it within the program, I think the data for that is incomplete and not as compelling.